Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's Tom Hartman with you. It is Friday, the 31st of October, All Hallows Eve. Probably the scariest thing out there is that Tom DeLay is still doing TV shows when he should be in prison in Texas. Why don't they introduce this guy's indicted felon, Tom DeLay? Anyway, it's All Hallows Eve, and of course, if it's Friday, and we're coming up on the election, if it's Friday, it's Senator Bernie Sanders with our national town hall meeting. I think of him as America's senator. He's not a Democrat or a Republican. He's an independent in the United States Senate. Was the longest serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives before going to the Senate. Represents the great state of Vermont, where we're on the air on several radio stations. And Bernie, welcome. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
And I should add, by the way, your website is sanders.senate.gov. You've got a great newsletter and a great website. It's turned into a really good news site.
Yeah, and we have been focusing lately on the financial crisis. So if people want to visit us, we'd love that. We've got a lot of good information there. Well, Tom, as we all know, this is the last show that we will be doing before what is, in reality, the most important election in my lifetime.
Yes.
And I just hope a couple of things. I hope, first of all, that nobody takes all of this polling out there all that seriously and understand that polls, this is a very strange time, and that while I hope that these polls are right, they may not be.
Well, there's one other variable here, Bernie. As the New York Times pointed out last week, in eight battleground states, over a million people have been deleted from the voter rolls in almost all every single case in violation of federal law. And in most cases, like in Florida, for example, they've got an absolute match law. So, you know, my name is Thomas C. Hartman on my voter's registration and on my driver's license, but my Social Security record says Thomas Carl Hartman. So I would not be allowed to vote in Florida.
Well, there you go. So the point, the simple point here is
that's not reflected in the polls.
Nobody who is supporting Barack Obama should take this election for granted. Nobody should sit home and say other people are going to do it for me. So it's not only imperative that everybody who supports Obama gets out and vote, go out and drag your friends and your uncle and your aunts as well, and let us have by far the largest voter turnout than we have ever had. There are some very good signs. Well, you cautioned correctly, Tom, about some of the chicanery that's going on. On the other hand, what we're seeing in some states is a huge surge in early voting, and that looks promising. But let us be very clear. To win this election, we're going to need a massive voter turnout, and I hope that nobody takes anything for granted, that everybody comes out and does everything they can to bring out other voters. Also, I think I want to say a few words to those people who remain undecided, and there's certainly some of them. And I think some of those people appreciate and respect Senator McCain for his service to this country, which I think I do and many of us do. But what this election is about is not just McCain's personal history. It's not just Obama's personal history. What it is about is an understanding that this country right now faces more problems than we have seen since the era of the Great Depression. I think it is very clear, I don't think there's a whole lot of dispute about this, that on most of the important issues, certainly the economic issues facing this country, whether it is attitudes toward working people, whether it is unfettered free trade and the loss of millions of good-paying jobs, whether it is opposition to raising the minimum wage, whether it is health care, whether it is giving tax breaks to wealthy people who don't need it. On all of these issues and more, John McCain will give us four more years of George Bush. And I personally think that the middle class just is not going to be able to survive four more years of those policies. So while I know there are people who respect McCain's personal efforts on behalf of this country, I hope that they will be thinking more about the kinds of policies that we need in the economy, in education, in health care, in reducing our national debt, on the war in Iraq, on civil liberties issues, on all of these important issues. And I think if you think it through, you will come to the conclusion that Obama is the superior candidate.
Yeah.
So that's my message, Tom. People have got to work hard in the next 4 days, and let's see if we can do everything we can to elect Barack Obama.
If every one of us calls five people a day over the next 4 days, the multiplier effect will be dramatic.
That's right. And I sense out there a kind of excitement that I have not seen before. And I think a lot of it is Obama's own qualities, but the other part of it is such an anger and such a frustration and bitterness over these last 8 years, where we had a president who, in every single area, has moved us in the wrong direction. I think people are just chafing at the bit to end this moment in American history and move in a very different direction. I think as I've mentioned on this show before, I sit next to Barack Obama on several committees, on the Veterans Committee and the Health Education Committee. And in Obama, you have a very, very, very smart guy. And it's a guy who's obviously his intelligence is shining through in terms of the kind of campaign that he's run. He's run a brilliant campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But he also has a sense of history. He understands where America is today, and I think where America has to go. And our job is to work with him, is to get him elected, is to work with him to give him the strength and the courage to take on the very, very powerful special interests who exert more influence than the average person can begin to comprehend in Washington. So if you want to change the healthcare system, you're going to have to take on the insurance companies and the drug companies. They are enormously powerful. If you want to effectively deal with Wall Street, and if you want to deal with interest rates on credit cards, which are 30%, you're going to have to take on the financial services industry, which is, that's the banks and the credit card companies and Wall Street, enormously powerful. If you want to lower military spending and conclude that you don't need to spend $540 billion every single year on the military, you're going to have to take on the military-industrial complex and all the defense contractors and all these guys who make huge sums of money giving us weapon systems that we may not necessarily need at huge cost. If you want to come up with progressive taxation, which says that at a time when the United States has more income and wealth inequality than we've had since the Great Depression era, and that maybe it's appropriate that instead of the middle class and working families paying more and more in taxes, that we ask the wealthiest people in this country to stop paying their fair share, you're going to have to take on all the big money interest. So to move forward with a progressive agenda, Obama is going to need the grassroots support of millions and millions of people. And one of the very exciting aspects of this campaign is that he has already run the strongest grassroots campaign in memory. The fact that he has 3 million individual contributors to his campaign is absolutely extraordinary. And so I think what we have got to do, and you know, you and I do this and our listeners do this on the show every week, we talk about what is a progressive agenda? What does a progressive agenda look like? How do we move to a national healthcare system guaranteeing healthcare to all people? How do we make sure that every American is able to go to college regardless of income? Where do you get the money to do that? What's the best way to end the war in Iraq? What we need is how do you address global warming, which is a huge issue, and use global warming, which is a very, very serious problem for our planet, as an opportunity to create millions of jobs as you move to energy efficiency and wind and solar and geothermal and biomass. Millions of jobs can be created building, moving in those technologies, getting automobiles that are hybrid plug-ins or electric cars, moving toward mass transportation. There are just enormously exciting opportunities out there. But every step of the way, trust me, will be resisted by one powerful special interest who are making a whole lot of money out of the current situation. So we've got a lot of work in front of us, but I think if we can win this, if we all come out to vote and bring our friends and and see that Obama gets elected. We have the opportunity for the first time in years of really moving this country in a very, very different direction, which will give a lot of hope, I think, not only to people throughout our country, not only the working families who are struggling so hard right now, but I think to people all over the world.
Yeah, this could really repair our relationships with much of the world, just a single act.
Yes, it certainly could. I mean, if you just contrast the attitude that the world had to us under Clinton, as opposed to now, it is like...
Yeah, Clinton was beloved wherever he went.
He really was.
George Bush goes to London, they have to lock down 5 square miles.
That's right.
I mean, it's martial law. 16 minutes past the hour, it's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Your opportunity to talk to a United States Senator, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com for our live chat room, sanders.senate.gov, Bernie's website, airamerica.com for our free video stream.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, that must be John McCain.
I've been around for a long, long year.
Yep.
So many a man, so
to be. Uh-oh. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Talk radio for the rest of us. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. And Bernie, shall we take some phone calls?
Let's do it.
Okay. Eva in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, hi, Senator Sanders and Mr. Hartman. This is Eva Hart. I was in the Army. And I want to call on about Joe the Plumber and his saying that paying taxes is so wrong. This article says that this hermit does not pay for what he gets because he enjoys all the comforts of civilization that he owes to the efforts of others, but contributes nothing himself. He's a tastefully self-centered man, does not interest himself in the poor, the suffering, the struggling. Therefore, I neither approve of him nor respect him. Source from English Grammar and Composition by Johnny Warner. Paragraph exercise article, also reader for College Entrance Examination Board 58 on a Libris website, bookstore. My closing thing, and I answer my question. Proverbs 29:14 says, a king keeps his throne forever in the cares for the rights and poor. Praise the Lord. And in a democracy, every individual is important. My question is, how would you defend the distribution of wealth and taxes?
I'm having a hard time hearing you. Can you...
First of all, we ask people not to read on the show because okay. it doesn't work. But after reading a few things, she said, how do you defend the taxes as redistribution of wealth?
Okay. How do I defend taxes?
She first of all started about by saying, you know, Joe the plumber wants to be a freeloader. He doesn't want to pay taxes, but he wants to take the benefits of society.
Okay. Well, here's the story. I mean, look. The story in terms of taxes is not very complicated. As a civilized society, we have a number of services which exist that protect us, which keep us alive, which makes us a prosperous country. You need a military to defend us. You need police. You need fire services. When you get up in the morning and you walk down the street, somebody has paved that road. Somebody takes the snow off of that road. We have schools in which we have teachers and et cetera, et cetera. And the question is, there are two questions. What in a civilized society should government be providing to people? And honest people differ on that issue. I myself believe, as a progressive, that government in a democratic, civilized society should be making sure that all of our people have at least a minimal standard of living. We should make sure that every kid in this country gets off to a good start with good child care, good educational opportunity. We obviously have got to protect the environment so that people don't get sick. I personally believe that we should have a national health care program which guarantees health care to all people. I think as a nation, we do better and are more productive and more prosperous when we have a strong infrastructure, when our roads and our bridges and our transportation systems are strong. All of those things cost money. And the question is, who should pay for it? How do you raise the money that we need to maintain the services that we as a civilized people in charge. It's the same question every country in the world has to ask, is asking. What has gone on in this country on the right-wing leadership is there has been an attempt to develop what we call the trickle-down economic theory, which says we're going to give tax breaks to the very, very wealthiest people, and somehow in a magical, mysterious way it's going to make the whole country more prosperous, which clearly has not happened. But also it pushes the tax burden down to the middle class, because if the federal government is, in some instances, not providing services for education, for example, it's going to be local property taxpayers who have to pick up the difference. The federal government is not contributing appropriately to infrastructure improvement. It's going to be state and local government that has to pay the freight. So I believe very simply that in society we should have a tax system that is based on ability to pay. If you're not making a whole lot of money, society shouldn't ask a whole lot from you because you can't afford it, because every dime you give is a dime that's not going into food or into basic necessities. But in truth, if you are a millionaire or if you are a billionaire, you know what? You're living in the greatest country on earth. You should make sure that our country remains great and our kids and our grandchildren do well as well. And you should pay a significant amount into the tax system. That is historically where we have been. When Dwight Eisenhower was president, the tax rate, income tax rate on the wealthiest people, if my memory is correct, was about 90%. It has gone down very significantly since then. So to answer Eva's question, I personally believe in a progressive income tax, and that is the more money you earn, the higher percentage of your income you pay in taxes.
Well said. Mark in the Twin Cities, Minnesota. Mark, we have a minute before the break here.
Okay, well, this can take longer than a minute, but given that the bailout's being used for everything but we were told it was going to do, and, you know, we can't trust the Treasury. It's obviously that the SEC has been asleep at the switch. I would like to get Senator's comment on the reintroduction of Senator Paul Wellstone's 2002 Consumer and Shareholder Protection Association Act.
Well, I'm not Paul Wellstone was a good friend of mine, and I'm sure it's good legislation. I'm not familiar with that. But I'll tell you this. If you're talking about the recent bailout, I have a lot of concerns about it. Among other things, we're going to be introducing legislation that makes sure that those millionaire CEOs who have brought us to the brink of ruin do not get one penny in bonuses, and that we make sure that that money goes where it was supposed to go and not to enrich people who are already quite wealthy and who have taken us to the brink of a financial collapse.
Right. So far, we have paid for stock in AIG exactly twice what Warren Buffett paid for the exact same stock. And the Financial Times is reporting that 10%, $70 billion, is going to be allocated for bonuses and payroll. So it's a tough one. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul because I think I'm better than you." The boy said, "My name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet you're going to regret, because I'm the best as ever been." "Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, because hell's broke loose in Georgia, and the devil deals."
Hell's broke loose in Georgia. Yes, Saxon Chambliss may go down. It's Halloween, and there's a lot of frightened Republicans out there. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. 34 minutes past the hour. By the way, quick heads up. Monday night, I will be live on Canadian television, Canadian Broadcasting, CTV, www.ctv.ca at 9:45 p.m. Eastern Time, on a panel of liberals and conservatives on the U.S. presidential election on November 4th, Election Day. I'll be doing election coverage with Air America Radio, with Sirius Satellite Radio, with a couple of local affiliates. On November 16th, we're heading out for a week for the Air America Cruise to Belize and Guatemala. And on December 10th, I'll be here in Portland at Powell's for a book signing in their Burnside location at 7:30 p.m. And that's everything that's coming up. It's Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Bernie, back to the calls?
Yep, let's do it.
Okay. Let's see here. Carol in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Carol, what's on your mind?
I was wondering, since those of us on the left have known about all the election shenanigans and outright criminal things from the election 4 years ago, how come we never heard of anybody working on any of this until the last few months?
Well, Carol, not quite correct. I should tell you that in this campaign, if my memory is correct, Obama has about 5,000 volunteer lawyers in every state of this country to make sure that people who are eligible to vote do, in fact, vote. They are more than aware of what's happened in the past, and they're going to do everything they can to prevent it. Having said that, you know, frankly, in the year 2008 in the United States of America, this whole election system, the way we're doing it, is just really pretty sad. And we can do a lot better, and it's an issue that we have to take a very hard look at. People all over this country are worried about touchscreen voting machines and whether their votes are accurately counted, whether intentionally or just through problems in the machine. There are long, long lines. We are hearing right now that in some cases people who are voting early are waiting in lines for 3 or 4 hours. And not everybody can do that. People have got to get back to work. That's a form of discrimination. I think in the United States of America, frankly, we can create a system where everybody has 100% confidence that the vote they cast is in fact counted, and they don't have to wait half their lives to cast that vote. So that's an area that we need to spend some time on, and we will. But what's going on right now, I think in the hearts of many people, there is just real concern. So we've got to make real improvements there.
Bernie, just on that note, Rick Hasen, who runs a blog called the Election Law Blog, which is a really serious, good, solid, you know, not, oh, conspiracy stuff thing, whatever, he suggests that because the Constitution gives Congress broad authority over congressional elections, that either the president or some enlightened legislator should propose legislation that would mandate that the Census Bureau in 2010, when they do the every 10-year census, register everybody that they identify as a citizen and take over the responsibility annually for registering voters.
Well, that's not a new idea. And that fact exists, I think, in many countries. I think it exists in Canada.
Yeah.
If my memory is correct, it is not the political parties that register people. The assumption is you don't have to, when they want to get taxes from you, they fine you. And there's a mechanism by which you pay taxes. I think we should also make sure that when people reach the age of 18, they're eligible to vote.
Right.
It
well
shouldn't
said.
Be a difficult thing to do.
Yeah,
and
very well said.
The point that Rick makes is a good point.
Yeah, and if you have to sign up for the Selective Service at 18, males anyway, that's another way. Anyhow, Rich in Stratford, Connecticut. Rich, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
My question is that Bush is going to be launching a lot of deregulation in the next couple of weeks. Is it possible to stop any of them through the congressional comment period, or is that going to be just a rubber stamp?
Did you see the article on this in this morning's Washington Post?
No, I didn't.
There's over 90 rules that the Bush administration is proposing, including new standards for oil spills, new rules governing employees who try to take family and medical-related leave. It's really pretty third rule would increase emissions from oil refineries, chemical factories. Another rule would ease emissions on coal-fired plants near national parks. Another is an EPA rule that would stop regulating carbon dioxide. All of these things, two other rules nearing completion would ease limits on pollution from power plants. Bush, these are all, you know, executive orders that he can push through before he leaves office, and it may take a year or 2 years to undo any of them because they require, hearings and things to undo.
Well, that's not necessarily true. Sometimes it doesn't take a year or two. I'm not familiar with it. I haven't seen that article. Mm-hmm. But I think we have to be prepared to move vigorously in every regard to undo the damage that Bush has done. And certainly any shenanigans that take place in the last couple of months, we have to move very aggressively to also address.
Yeah, okay. I agree. The article, by the way, it's called The Last Push to Deregulate by Jeff Smith in this morning's Washington Post. You can check it out. Armin in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hey, Armin, been a while since we've heard from you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, Bernie. How you doing?
Good.
Bernie, my wife and I already went out and voted for Obama. We proudly wear our buttons in the malls and wherever we go, and you would not believe the positive response we're getting from people that you might otherwise think politically wouldn't have those leanings. They're coming up to us. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And the question I have, Bernie, you're very brilliant. You're a wonderful senator. The question I have is, outside of an international global boycott of the mainstream medias in this country, can you think of any way that we could efficiently and rapidly get balance back into the media? And, you know, it's not liberal, it's not conservative, it's like Tom says, and he's very brilliant, it's basically just corporate short-term bottom-line profits.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so how can we, based on your knowledge of the Senate, and like you say, Bernie, there's too much money. There's too much money in the system, and you know what money does.
Yeah.
So can I listen?
You've raised a very important question, and Tom and I every now and then discuss it, and Tom knows a great deal about it. Despite what the right wing says about the so-called liberal media, the reality is, almost by definition, that the major media outlets in this country, whether it's NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, whether it's the major radio stations, are owned by people who have a whole lot of money and large multinational corporations. And the concern that many of us have is that over the years we have seen fewer and fewer large media conglomerates control what the American people see, hear, and read. Now, one of the very positive developments, of course, that's taken place in recent years is the Internet, which has opened up a whole lot of opportunities for people to get different points of view than they may see in their daily newspaper or on the television. Armin, I think there's a lot that we have to think about in that regard, and it is a major priority of mine. I think we need it to be a vibrant democracy. The American people are going to have to hear different points of view. They have to hear intelligent debate. They have to hear politicians talking in other than six-second sound bites. So there's a lot of work that has to be done. I think, for a start, one way that we can move forward is support programs. I'm not being self-serving here, but we need people to say to their local radio stations that they just don't want to hear right-wing stuff. Rush Limbaugh is fine, but they want to hear other points of view as well. There are communities all over this country which are progressive communities where you can't hear a progressive radio show, for example. And I think one of the things that we should be doing as citizens is going to the local radio stations and demanding alternative points of view. If you are living in a city where you have a newspaper that only has right-wing columnists, drop into the editor and tell him or her that you want to hear different points of view. I think in Washington, for a start, what we're going to do is make sure that we stop this growing concentration of ownership, that we support local control of media rather than one big station owning so many other stations. But there's a lot that has to be done, and this, to me, is certainly one of the important issues facing our country.
Hmm. Well said. Steve in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Steve, you're on the air.
No,
Steve.
Picking up on what you just said about the, you know, the concentration of the right-wing media and stuff like that, this campaign has been filled with a lot of character assassination, especially on the right against Obama. And I'm wondering, after he's elected, if he is elected, I don't want to assume anything, is he going to be able to govern the way he wants to by reaching across the aisle? Will that actually happen? Will we be able to come together as a people and solve our problems? Or is the hatred going to be there after the election so much on the right that they won't let him get anything done?
Well, Steve, you've raised a very interesting question. I was appalled. I mean, I've been in a number of campaigns. I've had some really, really ugly negative ads thrown at me in Vermont. But when you have a United States Senator, John McCain, sending out a robocall, which in essence says that Barack Obama is working with terrorists, I mean, that is just unbelievable to me. It is really stunning. It is horrendous. And you're going to have some people out there who think that if Obama gets elected, you're going to have a terrorist in the White House. We'll talk about that in after the break.
Okay, we'll pick it up on the other side.
That's a very good question.
Yeah, he does. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour every Friday here on the Tom Hartman program. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov is website, tomhartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com for our live free video stream. Check it out. We'll be right back.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman program at hartmanradio.com.
Hiking past the White House late one night, when our eyes beheld an eerie sight. The president appeared with folks very strange, the zombies and vampires of global climate change. It's not global warming, say oil company disciples. Our math tells us it's natural weather cycles. These claims from industry heavies, let the president rest behind his own protective levees. They're doing the climate mash.
The climate mash.
Real science is bad.
The climate mash.
Solutions are tried.
The climate mash.
And they do it for the cash.
Yeah.
The creatures were having fun. Our Congress was overrun. We couldn't tell the mindless zombies from the elected ones. Now we can stop this. We have the technology. But first we have to get past industry ideology. We need your help. I'm glad to show you how. Tell your leaders in Washington to save our climate now.
Amen.
Heck of a job,
zombie. Heck of a job, zombie. And it is going to be the election, isn't it, Bernie?
That's right. Let me get back, if I can, to Steve's question. Steve essentially asked whether McCain's very, very negative campaign is going to make it harder for Obama to bring the country together. And I think to some degree that's true. When you go around calling a guy who may very well, and I certainly hope, become president, when you essentially say that he's a terrorist, for millions of people, it is going to be hard for them to begin respecting this guy in the White House. On the other hand, Obama has those qualities, I think, of trying to bring people together. He speaks about that in every single speech. He talks about this not being a red America or a blue America, but a red, white, and blue America, all of us being Americans. So I think he takes that issue very seriously. And he is well suited to try to reconcile and bring together a very divided nation. But I would also reiterate what I said earlier, is that we are going to need in Washington grassroots support all over this country to push Congress to do the right things in terms of representing the needs of working families and the middle class, because the special interests there in corporate America and these guys with, you know, billions of dollars in money, they are very, very powerful. And I think what we have seen in the Obama campaign is really a very exciting grassroots level of activism. And we've got to continue that effort through the election, obviously, for the next 4 days, and after the election, if we're going to move this country in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Sarah in Sterling, Virginia, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, I'm from Northern Virginia, the real America, according to Sarah Palin. Anyway, my question is, what do you think the status is going to be of Joe Lieberman after the election if you all get your majority, well, majority? And I know it's free speech for him to go and campaign, but I know he's chairman of a committee. Does he lose that chairmanship, I hope? And I would love to know if there's a recall motion, you know, in his state for what he has done. Let's hope that they can have a recall mechanism in California. Let's have one in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah, I'm not sure that you can recall the United States Senator in any state, but and it's hard to say what will happen. It will depend on the elections and the Democratic caucus, and I'll be part of that. We'll make the decision. What I can tell you, I think, is that people, there are a number of members of the Senate who are upset, not just that at a time when all of us want to move this country in a new direction, that Senator Lieberman is supporting McCain, but the tone of some of his comments as well. So we will see what happens. The caucus reconvenes in mid-November, and I think you'll probably see a lot of discussion on that issue at that time.
It's good. It's going to be an interesting year, I'll tell you. It's going to be a very interesting year. Dave in Indiana. Dave, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, a question, and if I could, before you answer it, if I could make a comment. I was wondering, with all this thing about Obama's background, is there a FBI background check run on senators, House members, and presidential candidates before they enter office? And also, why it's so important for the Republicans to flip the election or whatever is because they can't afford to have Obama win, because if Obama wins and is able to put all his policies in place, the Republican middle class and the Christian right will find that the Republican Party has been lying to them, because the truth is a mortal enemy of the lie, and thus by extension the truth is the greatest enemy of the state, or in this case the Republican Party. That's Joseph Goebbels. And also, if you remember back in 2000, or there were reports, or 2004, there were reports that the new Diebold voting machines, there's cell phones in there. So the Secretary of State in Ohio was actually had a website that for the first two or three hours had live results of the voting. So they can tap into these things and they know how the voting is going. Fortunately, this time, Ohio, I think, has a lot of paper ballot backups. Pennsylvania doesn't, so that might be a flip vote state that they may do.
Okay, Dave, you've raised a whole lot of issues out there. I'm not quite so sure about the last one. But the answer to your question is, does the FBI do a background check? The answer is no. But I can assure you that when you run for the United States Senate, or especially when you run for President of the United States, you have an enormous amount of opposition research. I am sure you have very bright, skilled, well-paid people who have gone over every day of Barack Obama's life, everything that he has written, every person that he's ever talked to, in order to get some dirt on him. In terms of their focusing on his background and his alleged activities and so forth and so on, I think a lot of that has to do, as Dave indicates, with the bankruptcy of what the Republican Party stands for. If you don't have anything to say about the collapse of the middle class, the disintegration of our healthcare system, a foreign policy which got us into the war in Iraq, which is costing us $10 billion a year, the fact that we have the most unequal distribution of income of any major country on earth, the fact that we're losing millions of good-paying jobs because of our absurd trade policies, which McCain very strongly supports. If you don't have anything to say on the real issues, you got to move to diversionary tactics and create a whole lot of gossip and try to attack somebody in negative and vicious ways, which is essentially what their campaign has been in.
That's all they've got left. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. Get over there to his website and sign up for his newsletter. Bernie, thanks so much for being with
us. Good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Anything Goes Friday, coming up next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here. And, of course...
God, the dead have risen and they're voting Republican.
Oh, Bart Simpson, the dead have risen, they're voting Republican. Look out! Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see. In any case, by the way, November 5th, Guy Fawkes Day, Natalie Portman playing the role of Valerie in V for Vendetta.
Remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
No, Guy Fawkes was a religious crazy who wanted to turn England from a constitutionally limited democracy, a democratic monarchy, into... Actually, it wasn't constitutionally limited. They had the classic rule of law, legal precedent. But nonetheless, he wanted to turn into a theocracy. He was defeated, and every year they celebrate it by basically burning Guy Fawkes in effigy. But here's the consideration for America, and how I think in many ways the movie V for Vendetta recast that. We have now had for 8 years a religious fanatic who has been defying the constitutional norms of our government as president. It's like Guy Fawkes took over. And Guy Fawkes Day in England is saying, you know, remember the gunpowder treason? Well, I think we had the gunpowder treason. And instead, what we need to be saying is, I mean, there's some great lines from this movie. Instead, what we need to be saying is,
no more tricks. No more lies. Only truth.
There you go. Thank you, V. So, okay, we're going to do Anything Goes Friday, and I'd like to just do a slight change from the normal way that we take calls here, and let's try this out. One thing. We'll just boil it down to one thing. The fact of the matter is, every day, literally every day, there are many, many, many people who call into the program. The vast majority, well over 90%, never get on the air. And let's try to get a whole bunch of people on the air over the next 2 hours and just bring as many people in as possible. I, of course, being the talk show host here, will reserve my right to rant, but I'll try to keep it minimal as well, except when it seems appropriate. But please don't call and say, you know, I've got three comments, two soliloquies, three things I want to read, and four questions. One thing. You may make one point or one question. If you want to make a second one, you can call back after you're done. The number is 866-303-2270. But let's get as many people in as possible. No need to tell me how much you love the show or how great it is or thank me for being on or anything else. And I realize sometimes that'll just pop out by instinct. We're polite people and all that kind of thing. But just, you know, cut right to the chase. Get to your question, if you have a question for me or the comment that you want to make, and then we'll move on to the next person and let's see how many we can get in here. Chick in Dover, Delaware. Hey, Chick, what's up?
United Airlines just recently lost $500 million because they stockpiled jet fuel while the prices were soaring, thinking that it would go even higher.
Yeah, they didn't stockpile it. They bought options on it, but the same thing, yeah.
Okay. Is it possible that the investment banks, bankrolling speculators, is the straw that broke the camel's back for the investment banks?
Yeah, absolutely, to a large extent. And by the way, let's remember, there are no more investment banks anymore. They've all been done away with. But, yeah, actually, I'd say the larger thing is this unregulated market for basically bets, you know, the credit swaps and all these other kinds of derivatives. As William Seidman said, we played the clip on this program. I won't play it again right now, but the former head of the Resolution Trust Corporation that put back together the country put back together the SNLs after the disaster in the last Bush administration banking meltdown, Papa Bush, William Seidman pointed out that there was he created this thing called tranched securities, where they aggregated a whole bunch of mortgages from the old failed SNLs, divided them into these tranches, into these slices, and sold them off in international markets. And he went to Greenspan and he said, shouldn't these things be regulated? Shouldn't we at least keep track of how many there are? And Greenspan said, no, this is an opportunity to test the free market and prove that it really works. And instead what it did is it blew up in everybody's face, and there's over $500 trillion worth of derivatives out there when the entire planet's GDP is only $62 trillion a year. Mike in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, Mike.
Hi. The banking meltdown measured against Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, disaster capitalism.
Yeah.
You know, it surprised me and surprised myself that I didn't think of it beforehand. But, you know, it's really kind of a textbook example of that. And, you know, why didn't nobody pick up on that before the banking bailout was voted by Congress? I mean, certainly there was mismanagement, willful or ineptitude or whatever, but they created, you know, they being the bankers, created this thing, and then they did the classic Naomi Klein disaster capitalism.
I absolutely agree, Mike, yeah, an excellent point. And there was even one member of Congress who quoted Naomi Klein. I don't remember who it was, but I remember watching it. And I was talking on this program about how this was like that scene from Blazing Saddles, where the sheriff, you know, sticks his own gun to his own head and says, come any closer and I'll shoot the black guy, or words to that effect. And, I mean, this is what the banks did, and we did not need to flinch, and this thing has been a corrupt bailout, and Paulson is bailing out his buddies, Goldman Sachs getting all this money, all these other companies getting all this money, and they're getting much more favorable terms, much more friendly terms for the banks than Warren Buffett, for example. He's getting favorable terms. He's 2-1 over the U.S. government in terms of what he's getting for his money. Jerry in Holt, Michigan. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, Tom, long-term listener, and I like your program.
Thank you.
Hey, I've been seeing the news and seeing these huge lines, and this is historic turnout, and I don't understand. I don't think that they're in line for John McCain. I mean, I don't think this huge hubbub has been created through John McCain's campaign. So where is the, you know, what's the disparity between what we see as far as the turnout and what they report as these closing of the two campaigns and getting closer? It just, to me, it's doesn't seem to correlate.
Yeah, well, there's three things to consider. Number one, historically, early turnout has been Republicans, because Republicans tend to be the people who are well-organized. They get to the polls early. So there probably is a fair amount of early turnout that is Republican. Number two, the pollsters are still trying to figure out what to do about people who have cell phones. There's a whole huge cohort, I mean, tens of millions of people out there who have cell phones, who don't have landlines, and there's no cell phone directories published. So what do they do? How do they calculate those? I think that this is really screwing up the polls this time around. And number three, keep in mind, the corporate media wants a horse race. So they're going to report on everything that makes it look like a horse race, because if it's a horse race, if it's tight, then you're going to keep glued to the TV to find out what's going on. If it's a done deal, if it's a given, it's not. And for that matter, both campaigns want it to be a horse race, because they want everybody to show up and turn out, because if anybody thinks that it's in the bag, then they may not vote. So you've got a whole bunch of factors at work here, all aggregating them. We'll see. Blade in Dallas, Texas, listening on KMNY. Hey, Rational Radio. Hey, Blade, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Dallas, I'm driving. Anyway, I listened to your show. As I was going through the radio, I heard Dennis Prager. Are you familiar with him?
I debated him at the Democratic National Convention just a few months ago. Yeah, I've Dennis and I have talked many times over the years, actually.
Well, so I caught him in the middle of he was playing a tape of Biden on Ellen DeGeneres' show,
mm-hmm.
And she had said something about, you know, she's gay. Wondering his feeling on Prop 8 in California. And I don't know what that proposition is, but...
Well, let me just tell you very quickly, because we're on a lot of radio stations in California. Okay. Vote no on Prop 8. Prop 8 would amend the California Constitution to ban gay marriage.
Gotcha.
And gay marriage is now legal in California, and this is like going back to the miscegenation laws, if I'm pronouncing the word right, where it used to be illegal in many states for blacks and whites to marry. I mean, this is a basic civil rights issue.
I figured.
You know, so anyhow, your question.
Well, what Biden said to her was congratulations, and then went ahead and said that he and Obama, neither one would both vote against Prop 8.
Right.
And, you know, the whole crowd applauded and everything else. Well, then, you know, Prager, he cuts that off and goes back, takes a call from Minnesota, from a guy who just passed the bar who is, he's homosexual. Anyway, he said he's taking 50 or so other homosexuals to vote for McCain. Prager turned around and said, no self-respect. Now, this is not a quote because I'm not exactly sure what it was, but it was to the effect of no self-respecting homosexual would vote Democrat.
Yeah.
And well, I thought, absolute moron.
I know. Yeah. Dennis Prager has his own worldview, and he's not here to defend himself. I'm not going to pick on him for it, but there's a lot of, you know, misinformation and basically, you know, horse excrement being spread around right now, particularly on the right. They're twisting in the wind. Now, Prop 8, they've been using a lot in California. They've been using a lot of fear tactics. They've been using outright lies in promoting Prop 8. It's really important that everybody in California who can vote. You know, you may think it's in the bag in California for Obama. It may be. But get out there, if for nothing else than to vote no on Prop 8. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, indeed. Happy Halloween, 21 minutes past the hour.
I would like, if I may, to take you on a strange journey.
Yes, a very strange journey, in fact. Norm Coleman, at it again. I'm telling you, this is every election, four elections now, twice. Well, I'm mixing up my sons this year. Every election he has been in, the week before the election, Norm Coleman has sued his opponent. Twice he sued Paul Wellstone, of all people. And true to cause, he just filed a lawsuit against Democrat Al Franken. Yes. Norm Coleman is pathetic. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Just pathetic. He thinks he's got this formula. You know, the last week before the election, you sue. And it didn't work against Paul Wellstone. I mean, back when he was mayor, he tried. It's so sad. We need 60 votes. This is my blog today over at airamerica.com. We have to have 60 votes in the United States Senate. If we don't, Barack Obama will not be able to have an effective presidency. That means that you have to get out there and get active for Jeff Merkley in Oregon, for Norm Coleman in Minnesota, and for all those other races that are on the edge, whatever state you may be in, it is so important to vote for a Democrat for United States Senate. It is so important. Gene in Los Angeles. I'm listening on K-Talk. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Hi. I don't want to put in jeopardy those 60 votes needed, but I wanted to ask about campaign spending limits. I mean, it's very hard for me personally to get really motivated about an election when, you know, the campaign spending limits law that Congress implemented, I mean, failed to implement after they passed it. I'm talking about the law in 1974, the federal elections law.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, now the campaigns are spending like 20, 30, you know, in some cases 50 times more than that law called for.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Here's the problem.
I'm not talking about public financing. I'm not into public financing. I think it's unnecessary. It's too confusing.
Well, here's the problem, Gene. The Supreme Court has ruled that of all forms of protected speech, political speech is the most protected. And that spending money on advertising is a form of speech. And so in the United Kingdom, you can't spend more than £100,000 on an election. And that's why their elections only run for 2 or 3 weeks. But in the United States, the Supreme Court has ruled that you can't limit spending on political campaigns. You can limit contributions. So,
an
individual can't give more than $2,300 and a corporation can't give anything. But you can't limit spending.
There are ways around that, though.
For example.
For example, you could say, okay, every campaign, you can only receive, let's say if you're a race for mayor of Los Angeles, your campaign cannot receive more than $20 million. That's an ample sum of money, right?
Yeah, but
your
campaign
cannot receive more than that. That's campaign contribution limits. That is acceptable,
No, it's not. Under my reading of the Supreme Court, and I may be wrong, perhaps you're right on this, Gene, but I'm pretty sure it's not.
Okay,
I think the only way
point,
to do
one
it...
One more point.
Sure.
Ultimately, it doesn't really matter. What would be the harm in if the government just went ahead and implemented campaign spending limits all over the country? Would the country come to an end? No.
No, but the government's not going to do it, Gene. I mean, that's the bottom line. It ain't going to happen. Here's the way to do it. It's what we do here in Portland, Oregon. If you can, and you just do a larger scale of this, it's a variation on what's done in Arizona and Maine, and it works quite well. It's done in other places around the world. If you can get in this city, in our city, we have a city of, I don't know, probably around 1 million people. I'm not sure the population. If you can get 5,000 people, if you can get 1,000 people to give you $5 and sign a petition, then you get $100,000 in cash from the city. Now, in the last election, one of the candidates who one of the guys who actually, you know, put this thing on the ballot did this, got his $100,000 and then an opposition candidate who was funded in part by a public power company that Eric had been that the local candidate had been working against essentially put up $100,000 for an opposition candidate. Well, then they gave her another $25,000, the opposition candidate. So when your opponent gets another $25,000, then the city gives you another $25,000. If your opponent gets another $50,000, the city gives you another $50,000. So what happened is every time Ginny Burdick got more money from basically the special interests, Eric Stenz's campaign, the guy who you know was the good guy who took the public financing, it became a news story. And his campaign got more money from the city. And so in the end, everybody saw whose pocket the opponent was in. And in the end, everybody saw how the thing worked. And Eric Stenz got reelected and Ginny Burdick was on the outside looking in. And frankly, I think that that's a model that could work all across the country. And we could do that. The fatal flaw in campaign financing, in federal financing right now, is the existence of the 401, or the 527s rather. All these groups out there that can pour unlimited amounts of money in. And they're much larger on the Republican side, frankly, than they are on the Democratic side, which is one of the reasons why Barack Obama backed away from this. And so if we were able to tighten that up somehow, and, you know, make it work, you know, like, and the simple way to do that is not to restrict the money coming in, because you can't legally do that. You can't constitutionally do that. But instead say, you're going to get more matching funds if people are spending 527 money on behalf of your opponent. For every dollar spent on behalf of your opponent, you get another federal dollar. And if every taxpayer in the United States put in $5 a year, we'd have billions of dollars to use.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back to your radio support group for We the People. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, our live chat room. Art in Wilaka, Florida. Hey, Art, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom? Thank you very much, and Air America for being so inspiring. We are, my wife and I are OFFOs, old farts for Obama. And we were wondering what happens if Cheney and Bush get impeached and get removed from office. Hopefully we can do that to get rid of this new move for them to cut down all our environmental, very hard-won procedures. That makes Nancy Pelosi the president, right?
It would, if it were to happen, Art. It's not going to happen. I can guarantee you it's not going to happen. There is not the will for that in this Congress, and it's one of the reasons why I hope with a new Congress that we will have some new leadership, at least in particular in the Senate. David in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, I've been hearing you guys talking a lot about voter fraud and voter suppression, and well, I live in Oklahoma, and I happen to think that the ballot system that we have is one of the better ones in the country. But I'm really concerned about what's going on with the voting system, and my real interest is how can we stop this from happening in the future? I mean, it happened 8 years ago, you know.
Yeah.
Here's
the problem, David. The Help America Vote Act, which was pushed by the Republicans after the debacle in Florida, was supposed to solve the problem. Instead, it was part of the privatization. The commons in the United States is the stuff that we all collectively own. And we all collectively use the air we breathe, the water that we use. In most communities, it's municipalities that own the water supply or local governments. The waste, the septic systems. Actually, the majority of power companies in the United States are publicly owned. I think they should all be publicly owned. I think this is part of the commons. Our public schools, our fire departments, our police departments. And the commons, you know, our space program, our air traffic control system, our roads, our public parks, this is the commons. And the ultimate of the commons is our government, because it is the instrument that administers the commons, and our government is the ultimate of the commons, and our government is owned by us. And the way that we tell our government how to administer the commons is by our vote. And therefore, the vote is the most important part of the commons. Now, privatization is selling off the commons. And, for example, I live in a town where the electric utility has been privatized. It was sold to Enron, and now it's owned by a private corporation that's the result of the breakup of Enron. It should be publicly owned, in my opinion. But you could argue that that's a crime against democracy, that you've got private power. You got people making money off something that is a monopoly in a utility. But the ultimate crime against democracy is to privatize the vote. And that's what's happened. Our voter registration rolls are being handled by private corporations. Keep in mind, it was Choice Point, a Texas corporation that stripped 80,000 people off the voter rolls in Florida in 2000. African-Americans who simply had names that were even similar to felons in Texas and were not allowed to vote, that got that vote close enough that they could steal it from Al Gore. I mean, he actually won that thing, but nonetheless. So we've privatized our voter election lists, and we've privatized the vote with these damn voting machines and the machines that read the ballots. They're privately owned. It shouldn't be. And hopefully Congress will address this issue and say, sorry, no more privatization of the vote. That needs to be the mantra. No more privatization of the vote. Frank in Los Angeles. Hey, Frank.
How you doing? I wanted to ask Senator Sanders if he could introduce some legislation making it a felony for a candidate to spread lies about his opponent, you know, in the case of McCain and Sarah Palin, and calling Obama a terrorist because they're trying to identify his name with Osama bin Laden, you know.
Right. Yeah. Or Liddy Dole saying that her opponent is, whatever.
Yeah.
Or for that matter, in Minnesota now, we've got a case in Minnesota where one of the candidates, I had the story in front. I'll have to get the story up here in just a second. But wait a minute. I've got it. Where did it go? News of the day right here. Advertising experts say Democrat Ashwin Madia's skin might have been darkened in an NRCC ad running in the Twin Cities. Minneapolis's NBC affiliate Care 11 reported today. The son of Indian immigrants is in a tight race with Republican Eric Paulson for the seat of retiring GOP Jim Ramstad. And so, you know, the NRCC has darkened the ad. Unfortunately, again, as I said, free speech is most free when it comes to political expression, meaning that you can lie about a politician. Any politician can lie about any other politician. However, the response is to push back. And that's what Liddy Dole's opponent has been doing. That is what Ashwin Madia, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, is doing. I mean, push back. And, you know, truth ultimately is the ultimate disinfectant here. And it's the same thing. The Obama campaign has been running a very positive and above board campaign. And when the lies get just way over the top, they push back. And that's what I think, you know, that's the best way to do it. Greg in Fort Lauderdale listening on WINS. Hey, Greg.
Hey, mate. How are you doing?
Good.
I have a comment. Not being from the States originally, in 2000 and 2004, basically the election was stolen, or at least smelt very fishy when the results came in.
Yeah, no, they were both stolen, in my humble opinion, in Florida,
right,
but
right.
Both by disenfranchisement and then by the Supreme Court. And then in Ohio,
right.
We know that hundreds of thousands of votes never got counted.
Right. Well, if it happens again, I mean, do you think the American people will actually finally get off their rear ends and do something? I mean, in Europe, if that happened, the whole country would go on strike.
Yeah,
I mean,
and that would be my...
It would just shut down, you know? I mean,
yep.
But here, everybody just kind of shrugs their shoulders and kind of goes, oh, well, and starts whining about it.
Well, part of the problem, Greg, is that we have a media that is terrified of talking about these things, and we have a corporate media that's owned by the same people who own the voting machines companies. You have all these interlocking boards of directors. Go over to theyrule.net, they rule, like they rule, .net, and you can see all the interlocking boards of directors. It's really quite mind-boggling. But the question, will there be...
Remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot... I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Now, none of us would want any sort of violence on the 5th of November on Guy Fawkes Day if the election is stolen. But I think that a Gandhian type of action, where people simply walk out into into the pedestrian areas on streets and sit down, where people refuse to go to work, where people just sit down on the streets, where we have basically a Gandhi-like, a Jesus-like, a Martin Luther King-like, a Cesar Chavez-like strike and say, no, we're not going to take it. It's what we should have done in 2000. It's what we should have done in 2004. And if this election is stolen, it's what we should do in this election, in my humble opinion. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey Bernice.
Tom, I have a question about the separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
In Michigan, we have Proposal 2 on the ballot, which seeks to expand human embryonic stem cell research, essentially at the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a mass mailing by the Michigan Catholic Conference, and that's Cardinal Maida and, you know, several bishops, and they're calling this research intrinsically evil.
Right.
And I'm just, and it's, and also, it's the postage states that it's from a nonprofit organization.
Right.
And I'm just wondering where the wall is between church and state in a case like this.
Well, because they're not going after a candidate, I believe that they're somewhat protected on this. The deal that was made, and I think it was made in 1964, Lyndon Johnson was president when it was made, was that we will give those organizations that are doing noble work, schools, homes for abused kids, churches, those organizations that are doing the work that traditionally is not particularly well paid and that we all think that we need, and yet is not done by government. It's not part of the commons, but it's important stuff. We will give them free fire protection, free police protection, free use of our public roads. All those things that we all pay for with our taxes, the commons that I was talking about earlier, we will give them all that stuff for free. In other words, they will not have to pay taxes for that. In exchange for that, all we ask is that they keep their noses out of politics. And that's the simple rule, that a 501c3, that a nonprofit organization, an educational organization, a church, a religious organization, nobody is arguing that they should be silenced. But the argument is that they should lose their tax-exempt status if they participate in electoral politics. And I think it's been fairly narrowly defined as electoral politics being pro or anti a candidate rather than a position. So I may be wrong on this, but I don't think that that's the sort of thing that is considered an explicit violation. If instead they had said vote against so-and-so because of his position on this, then arguably that would be something that would be worth their losing their tax-exempt status. I think it should be expanded somewhat. On the other hand, then you have unions, which are also nonprofit organizations, that they would not be able to participate. I mean, although there are some variations on that because unions are democratic organizations, but it's a tough one, Bernice. And I think that the main thing that we need to do is go back to saying there is an absolute wall between church and state. There is a separation between church and state in the United States. The United States is not a Christian country or any other religious country. It is a secular democracy. The founders were very clear about that. The word God is not in our founding documents, other than, nature's God. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Broadcasting. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let me just go off on this for just a second here. This, this whole thing, I had a caller, or maybe it was a guest a day or so ago, was going off on, well, you know, America's a Christian nation. I just kind of let it pass because so very, very many times over the last 6 years that we've been doing this show, I have debated this with various people, although I realize, in fact, I got a couple of emails from people who are new listeners, because we've picked up, I think, 6 or 8 new radio stations in the last couple of months, and people have not heard my rant on this before, so I'm just going to go off on this, and then we'll get back to your calls for the rest of the hour and so minutes that we have. George Washington, for example, February 1st, 1799, Thomas Jefferson wrote in his personal diary, quote, this is he just writing to himself, right, in his diary. When the clergy addressed George Washington on his departure from the government, it was observed in their consultation that he had never on any occasion said a word in public which showed that he had a belief in the Christian religion. And they thought that he should. And so they tried to force him to declare publicly whether he was a Christian or not. However, Jefferson wrote in his diary, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address, particularly except that over which he passed without notice. And then Jefferson goes on to say, Washington never did say a word on the subject in any of his public papers, except in his valedictory address to the governors of the states when he resigned his commission in the army, wherein he speaks of the benign influence of the Christian religion. I know that Governor Morris, who pretended to be in his secrets, in other words, in Washington's confidence, and believed himself to be so, has often told me that General Washington believed no more in the fundamentalist Christian system than did he himself. Morris was a deist. The treaty with Tripoli, in fact, Jefferson, which was worked out under Washington's guidance and signed into law by John Adams, 1797, says, quote, as the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of the Muslims, and as the said states have never entered into any act of war or hostility against any Mohammedan nation, it is declared by the parties, blah de blah de blah. President James Madison, his first veto, February 21st, 1811, his first official veto as president, he was the fourth president of the United States, he vetoed a faith-based initiative. It was a law that gave money to the churches to care for the poor. His message to Congress, he said, and I quote, because the bill vests in said incorporated church an authority to provide for the support of the poor and the education of poor children of the same, it would be a precedent for the government giving to religious societies, and as such, a legal agency in carrying into effect a public and civil duty. In other words, this is something that the government should be doing itself, not giving money to churches. The government should not give money to churches. You read the letters between Jefferson and Madison. Jefferson was terrified that some religious crazy was going to become president of the United States. Madison said, that'll never happen. The American people aren't that stupid. What Madison was afraid of was the government would start giving money to the churches and the churches would be corrupted by the government. Madison was a Christian. Jefferson was not. Madison was afraid of the churches being corrupted by money from the government. And Jefferson said, oh, that'll never happen. And we're going to prevent that from happening. And in fact, Madison, it was his first veto. And then the quote, this famous quote from Thomas Jefferson that you find at the Jefferson Memorial, I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny imposed upon the mind of man. You'll find people constantly quoting that quote saying, oh, Jefferson, he was a very religious Bible-thumping guy. Look at this quote from him. Well, here's the quote in context. It's from a letter he wrote in 1800 to Benjamin Rush, a fellow deist and one of his very closest friends, a physician. He said, dear sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity which I have not forgotten. He was running for re-election. This was 2 months before the election of 1800. Thomas Jefferson running for election as president of the United States. He's the sitting vice president. I promised you a letter on Christianity. I do not know if it would reconcile the genus irritable vetum, which is Latin for the angry poets, who are up in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened. The delusion on the clause of the Constitution, which while it secured the freedom of press, he's talking about the First Amendment, covered also the freedom of religion, has given to the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes its own form to be the true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. The returning good sense of the country, he's talking about his being elected president, the returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes. and the preachers believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, but it is enough, too, in their opinion. So Thomas Jefferson, the words that he, you know, they're all quoting him. Oh, he was a real God-thumping Bible thing. He was saying the exact opposite. Talking about the Virginia law that he wrote, which ultimately became the First Amendment. Again, in his diaries, he talks about when the preamble to the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom declares that coercion is a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion, an amendment was proposed by inserting the word Jesus Christ. So it should read a departure from the plan of Jesus Christ, the holy author of our religion. The insertion was rejected by a great majority in proof that they meant to comprehend within the mantle of its protection the Jew and the Gentile, the Christian and the Mohammedan, the Hindu and the infidel. This is Thomas Jefferson writing in his own diary. In February 10, 1914, he writes to Dr. Thomas Cooper, "Finally, the answer to why the Ten Commandments should not now be part of the common law is because they never were. The Christian Heptarchy, the Heptarchy took place in the year 598. It was, and the last was about 688. Here was a space of 200 years during which the common law was in existence and Christianity was no part of it. We might as well say that the Newtonian system..."
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So anyhow, what happens when I get cranked up? I run out of my own words. The bottom line, welcome back. The bottom line of what Jefferson was pointing out is that people were saying that the U.S. law is based on English common law, and English common law is based on the Bible. And as Jefferson pointed out, English common law, it goes back to 536, and England was not converted to Christianity until the 700s. So for over 200 years, English common law, the basis of American law, was in a pagan nation. In fact, he said, this is just such a great quote, I just have to read you this. He says two things here. "We might as well say that the Newtonian system of philosophy is a part of the common law as that the Christian religion is. In truth, the alliance between church and state in England has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy and even bolder than they are." In June 5th, 1824, a letter to Major John Cartwright, he wrote, "Our revolution commenced on more favorable ground than the foundation of English or biblical law. It presented us with an album on which we are free to write what we pleased. We had no occasion to search into musty records, to hunt up royal parchments, or to investigate the laws and institutions of a semi-barbarous ancestry. We appealed to those of nature and found them engraved on our hearts." And that's why in the Declaration of Independence, he wrote, "The laws of nature's God." And John Adams scratched that out and said the Christian God, and Jefferson scratched it out again and said, no, it's nature's God. This is the law of nature. So, and I say this all as somebody who considers himself religious and spiritual and who calls himself a Christian. I think that it's better for religion if it's separated from government. So enough of that rant anyway. The economy is a big issue. Is the dollar going to go down in flames? A lot of people thinking so. Economyincrisis.com is a great website to check out on this. Anyhow, it's Anything Goes Friday. This is your day to call in, so I'm going to stop the rant here and get back to your calls. Just real quick, rule of thumb here. Please don't say I've got three comments and two questions or whatever. Just get right to it. No need to tell us that you love the show or anything. Just get right to your one point. If you want to make more than one point, you can call back and make the second point after your first point. And I'm just taking calls essentially in order here. Richard in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Richard.
Hi, Tom. I'm asking you to, if you have run across an email or a blog called "Would the Last Honest Reporter Please Turn on the Lights?"
You're talking about Orson Scott Card's piece.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Yeah,
sir.
Orson Scott Card is a libertarian. Libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. It is disingenuous at the very least, and it reflects a libertarian worldview. And I know that at least the copy that I got of it was headed, you know, Orson Scott Card is a Democrat. No, he's not. He's been on this show. I've interviewed him. You know, I love his writings. I don't like his politics. And it's just, you know, it reflects his libertarian worldview. Sean, thanks for the call. Sean in Vancouver. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom, there's been considerable consternation in the media and from Congressman Frank and Waxman about the fact that under the government bailout program, under the TARP, the Wall Street banks are receiving billions and the AIG guys, you know, they're going on these spa retreats.
Right. They seem to have scaled that back a little bit.
Well, sure. But to me, it's no mystery at all. As I know you're well aware of, in economics, there's a concept of externalities, and corporations are basically externalizing machines. Any cost that they can put off on the public, they will. And that's basically what we have going on here. So it's not that these Wall Street bankers haven't learned. It's that they've learned all too well that crime pays. They're basically running off with billions in profits that they've bonused themselves over the last several years and continue to bonus themselves, and they're putting all of the cost, all of the expense on us, the American taxpayer. And right now they're celebrating the fact that they've stuck it to us one more time. Your thoughts?
You're absolutely right, Sean. And in fact, as I referenced when Bernie was on, there was a piece in the Financial Times last week, which I shared with my listeners here, with you here, that said that some $70 billion of the $700 billion in the bailout bill is going to go ultimately to pay for bonuses and salaries. I mean, it's already pretty much decided. And your point about externalities, corporations, the first rule of operating a corporation is internalize profit, externalize costs. And so, for example, when we burn gasoline in the United States, we put things into the air that cause cancers. And we put things into the air that cause global warming. And we burn oil in the United States. And yet those costs are not paid for by the oil companies. It really costs about $10 to burn a gallon of gasoline, because there's about $3 worth of military expense protecting that oil and getting that oil to us. There's about $2 worth of health expenses, cancers and emphysemas and things that are caused by the burning of that oil. You know, there's another dollar that's involved in infrastructure costs. And then there's the $4 cost of the gallon of gasoline, which it will go back up to after the election. As I predicted, we're seeing gasoline dropping before the election. We're seeing the Dow go up before the election. We're seeing the dollar strengthening before the election. It's all going to change after the election. Count on it. So, you know, we'll see anyhow. Elaine in Long Island, New York. Hey, Elaine.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling today as a 52-year-old registered voter, and I'm going to be voting Tuesday. I'd like to be around for a lot more elections, so I'm here today to ask a lot of your callers to praise and purchase products that have no high fructose corn syrup. I know you've talked about it on your show a lot. And Arnold Bakery, Arnold Breads, the country white bread, we now purchase, and it proudly says on the top, no high fructose corn syrup. And if you go to their website, Arnold Bakery, you can contact them and thank them for doing that. And I'm also looking for other products along the way. So that's it. And I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Elaine. Yeah. High fructose corn syrup is not a food. It's a chemical. It's made by a chemical process. It was invented in the 1960s or 70s. And I lived in Atlanta, actually, when Coke did their reformulation to change from cane sugar to high fructose corn syrup, which is really what that was all about. And if you track, and this isn't just to make Coke the villain, I mean, this is the perverse consequence, you know, unintended consequences. We started subsidizing corn, so we got all this extra corn, and then they figure out that they can make a sugar-like substance out of this corn. So we put up tariffs against sugar and start selling this corn, and this corn syrup, if you track, you can see the graphs. You can Google this stuff. You track the rise of obesity in the United States. You track the rise of diabetes, type 2 diabetes in the United States. And it follows with about a 2-year lag, the introduction of and the rise in consumption of high fructose corn syrup in the United States. And I've been talking about that on this program for 6 years. And I know a bunch of callers have called in, and I know people personally who have simply taken high fructose corn syrup out of their diets, and they start losing weight and they get healthier. It's real simple. Tom in Long Beach. Hey, Tom.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Listen, Proposition 8 in California. As far as the government is concerned, all marriages, whether they're gay or straight, are civil unions. All right?
That's so right, because the government is not a religious institution.
That's right. And marriage is a religious institution, and it is only a religious institution. When you go to get your marriage license from the government, and then you go to get your marriage license from the church, you have to have them both if you want a religious marriage that's recognized by the government. Now, I'm a practicing Catholic. My Catholic faith teaches that marriage is between a man and a woman, and it's a holy sacrament, and man and woman become one flesh when they become married in a religious ceremony. That's not going to change, no matter what the government says. If the government were to ban Catholics from marrying everybody tomorrow, do you think Catholic priests are going to stop performing marriages? No. And it's an accident, frankly. It's a tradition that we've even bothered to continue calling what the government does marriage. It is a civil union. It's basically a business contract.
Yes, it is, by and large. It's a business and social contract, let's say, a secular social contract that deals with money principally in business things. Here's the problem, Tom. I know where you're going with this, and that is, why don't we just all, you know, change all federal and state laws that have to do with marriage to call them civil unions? I lived in Vermont when the civil union legislation was passed. And the problem with that is that there are thousands, literally thousands, of state, federal, and local laws on the books that use the word marriage. And so that's why I think it's so important that we acknowledge, that we all acknowledge personally and among ourselves.
Oh, I agree with that. What I'm trying to say is simply that no matter what the government does, marriage is still going to be marriage. And therefore, I think that even religious people can feel comfortable in voting no on California's Proposition 8 because it is a naked attempt to try to insert church doctrine into state law. And the reason they're doing it in the Constitution is because they know that if they pass it as a statute, it's going to be held as unconstitutional. And therefore, they have to change the state constitution, which in my humble opinion is way too easy to change in California, but that's another issue altogether.
Yeah, it should require at the very least a supermajority. Or far more than that. Yeah, no, Tom, I absolutely agree. And voting no on Proposition 8 in California is a civic duty. I mean, if you believe in the separation of church and state, if you believe in American democracy, if you believe in human and civil rights, you must vote no on Proposition 8. And, you know, if you live in California. And there are several other states, by the way, that have similar laws or similar proposals, propositions or ballot measures or whatever they're called in various states to ban gay marriage. And, you know, this is... And part, the reason, one of the other reasons why they put these on is to get Republicans to turn out to vote, because they know they're not going to vote for McCain.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The hour, defending America from the weapons of mass deception, the Tom Hartman Program, our conservative alert for the day, if I only had a brain alert. Yesterday, during an interview with a local Louisville, Kentucky ABC affiliate, reporter Mark Herbert asked Sarah Palin about reports that she doled out political positions to friends, family, and campaign donors. When Palin said the people she hired weren't cronies or politicos, Herbert asked, they weren't politicals, they were just folks who deserved the job? Absolutely yes, Palin replied. Yet, according to the LA Times, more than 100 appointments to the state's posts, nearly one in four, went to campaign contributors or their relatives, often without apparent regard to qualifications. Alaska historians say some of Palin's appointees were less qualified than those of her Republican or Democratic predecessors. What a surprise. What a surprise. I am shocked. I am shocked.
I'm shocked. Shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
Indeed. Impossible. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mitch in Sycamore, Illinois. Hey, Mitch, what's up?
Hello. I just want to say that, you know, right now Chrysler and GM are asking for federal funds to fund the merger.
Yeah.
I just got done working for them until they said bye-bye. And what I would like to say is they've had a rule to their suppliers. Reduce the cost 7% per year or you're gone, causing thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans to lose jobs. And I'd like to
say... Well, what's happened is their suppliers are going to China to get their stuff made.
Yeah, but they have to make that 7%
right.
reduction per year.
Right.
I would like to see a stipulation. If we give them a dime, they got to bring 10% of their production back every year if they want to keep any kind of federal funding. Plus, we should get federal ownership of that portion of them. And I'd like to say that I know how many parts it is. It's 27,000 parts on their tiniest car that they make
yeah.
that are
Mitch,
foreign made. Only the body is put together and the screws put on here. That's it.
Yeah. Mitch, in France, for example, I think it's Peugeot. The French government owns about 30% of it. I mean, there's a precedent for government coming in and saying, we'll bail you out and we're going to hold the stock and someday we'll sell it. With regard to Chrysler and GM being required to hire people back, though, the problem is if they can't sell the cars, what are those people going to do?
Well, if the people aren't, if they're required to make it here, people somewhere will have jobs. The money will start trickling up.
Well, no, what we need to do is we need to make it so that they are more easily sold here. And the way you make it so that they are more easily sold here is you say, if you want to make a car in the United States where it's $25 worth of labor on the assembly line or $30 worth of labor with all the costs in it, that's fine. If you want to make this a car to sell in the United States, in Taiwan or in Mexico, for example, then when that car hits the border, there is going to be a tariff on that car, on the import of that car. We're going to charge you a 10, 20, 30% import tariff on that car to reflect the difference in the cost of labor between making it in Mexico and making it in the United States.
You're completely concur. Let me get back in line for my next point.
Okay, yeah, I'll do that. I mean, that's the bottom line, is we need to go back to simple tariffs. It's just that simple. When Michael Moore documented this brilliantly in his book, Roger and Me, GM shut down 5 plants in Flint, Michigan, and opened 5 plants in Mexico. They couldn't have done that before when we had tariffs. It wouldn't have made any sense. Pat in Grapevine, Texas. Hey, Pat.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for what you do.
You're welcome.
Here's my question. I listen to you on Rational Radio 1360. Thanks mm-hmm. for coming back to North Texas. But my question is, all of these undecideds that we are waiting on to decide the election,
mm-hmm.
do you think if they can't figure it out by now that they really will show up on Tuesday and wait in line for 4 or 5 hours to put their vote in?
You know, it's hard to say, Pat. I think that the undecided voters fall into 3 categories. Number one, there's dumb people who just, you know, they're low information voters. They don't know what's going on. They're probably not going to vote, and they're probably not going to stand in line. Number two, there are people principally of the old school who think that their vote is their own damn business, and they're not going to tell anybody how they voted.
Okay.
And those people probably will show up to vote. And number three, there are people who are so busy, they're working so hard, they would like to vote, they have an opinion sort of, but they haven't really made it. And those people, I think, fall into that category that you're talking about. They're not going to stand in line for 6 hours. They're not going to do the work. So probably we make a mistake by saying, any politician makes a mistake by saying that they're going to pay a lot of attention to undecided voters. Scott, Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Scott, break coming in a minute. What's up?
Okay, Tom, I'll do it in a minute. You know, you talk about it being a Christian nation. We could use some loaves and fishes action and some hands-on healing action.
Yeah, we're not a Christian nation. We're just a nation with a lot of Christians.
Well, for older people, for disabled people, and for retired people, you know, when things get bad, it hits everybody hard. But those who are on fixed incomes, who need, you know, health care and affordable housing, it is like a real, it's a much worse kick.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
When you vote on Tuesday, consider... There's a lot of people who think, oh, it's just fine now. Well, if it's so fine, then try it for a while and see how fine it is.
Yeah, this is the essence of every major religion in the world, is that we're all in this together, that we are our brother's keeper, that we care for the poor, that we house the homeless, that we heal the sick, that we feed the hungry. It's in Christianity, it's in Matthew 25, and there's a great political group out there. It's become a religious group that has endorsed Barack Obama. Matthew25.org. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Christmas all day long here on Halloween. 34 minutes past the hour. Get out there and vote, and be sure that you call every day between now and Tuesday five people, five friends, and make sure that they're voting as well. If you're in a state where you've got early voting. And if not, then on Tuesday, take the day off and volunteer to help out, help getting people to the polls, because we really need to make this election work. And we just really need to see the polls. Okay, a crazy alert for the day. Mr. Methane. Yes, Mr. Methane is promising to blow away audiences. The world's only full-time performing flatulist is promising to blow away audiences at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. Mr. Methane, alias former train driver Paul Oldfield, will reveal his unique skills in a show called An Audience with Mr. Methane. In it, he tells broadcaster Martin Kellner how his talent came to light when he accompanied his sister in yoga practice. At first, it was nothing more than a party trick to entertain fellow railwaymen, but eventually Mr. Methane found that by careful control, he could pick out a simple tune. He has gradually expanded his repertoire, which now ranges from Strauss's Blue Danube Waltz through Kyle Montague's I Should Be So Lucky. Now, who's crazier? The people who are going to see Mr. Methane and hear him, or Mr. Methane himself? I don't know. It's a toss-up. Kim in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Kim, you're on the air. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I realize this is probably trivial in light of the wars and housing foreclosures and the bad economy, but I was wondering if I'm the only person in the United States truly appalled that the quote-unquote creationist Sarah Palin might sit on the Board of Regents of the Smithsonian and be put head of NASA?
Yeah. Well, keep in mind George Bush is a creationist, too. At least as far as
yeah, but
know.
He wasn't in charge of those things. Cheney was, and he's not a creationist.
Oh, the vice president is in charge of those things?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Oh.
I didn't realize that. I thought you meant if she.
No. The vice president is put on the Board of Regents of the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
And heads NASA.
Just the whole idea of Sarah Palin being either vice president or president is
well, I realize that, but the Smithsonian.
Terrifying.
How can you put her in thousands of years of history?
Well, you know, in the national parks right now, the park rangers are forbidden, literally forbidden. There's a gag order, forbidden from talking about the age of the fossils in the national park.
Oh God.
I'm serious. I mean, this is what you get from having a creationist as president. So, Kim, it would not be a pretty picture. I guess that's all I can say about it. Thanks for calling and bringing up the issue, though. It's Chris in Long Island, New York. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. Good afternoon. You know, with all the talk about the wealth redistribution, the wealth redistribution that really annoys the heck out of me is seeing our tax money go to an unjust war and have $7 billion be filtered to Halliburton's and the Bechtels on non-bid contracts. I don't hear anybody talking about that. And if that's not a direct redistribution of tax dollars, you know, to say nothing of really the injustice and the fact that the military was shrunk to the point where they privatized things which could have been, you know, taken care of by, you know, military personnel at a, you know, much less and probably more efficient, you know, way of going about it.
Well, and not only that, the reason why you want soldiers doing KP, you want soldiers peeling the potatoes and cooking the food, is not only the fact that they're more likely to make sure that the food they're serving their fellow soldiers is healthy, because now we've seen these private contractors serving contaminated food to the soldiers and contaminated water, but also because if you are in a potential firefight, you don't want the soldiers to have to protect the private contractors. You want the cook to be able to pick up his rifle and say, okay, I'm a soldier now. I mean, it is, you're absolutely right. It's a scam, Chris. And by the way, it started with Reagan. Reagan was the guy who said, okay, let's redirect $2 trillion to his buddies in the defense industry for the so-called Star Wars program. Did it. He did it and broke the bank, ran up this huge, huge debt here in the United States. It was a crime. Christina in West Hill, California. Hey, Christina.
Christina, hi. I'm Christina. Yes, hi. Tom wanted to say I'm from Sweden originally, and I'm just so resentful when people talk about the socialist countries as a bad country. Sweden is a social democracy. We have health care. We have education. I read an article recently that said about 7 to 10 people in percent of the people in Sweden and Denmark are religious and go to church. Yet we take care of our own. So yep. many people in this country are swear to religion, and, you know, what do? They don't take care of their people here.
Yep, and this is why Bernie Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist.
Yes.
You know, he's referring to the Swedish system and others. We did, in March of this year, we did our program, was it March or maybe June? Anyway, a few months ago, we did our show for a week from Denmark, from Copenhagen. Another social democracy. And, and it was just remarkable. I had on, and thank you for the call, Christina. We had on the, I believe it was the equivalent of the vice president of the company, of the country. And as I recall, and I asked the question, you know, how many of your people have to declare bankruptcy or get wiped out by illness? And he blinked and he said, I beg your pardon? Like, you know, is this a serious question? Is that even possible anywhere in the United States? Lee in Pinckney, Michigan, you want to disagree with me about high fructose corn syrup?
I think. Yeah, I heard on news, I don't remember which one, but just a couple of weeks ago, they officially made high fructose corn syrup a food through the FDA.
Oh, I see. So it's officially called one. Because a lot of people mix up corn syrup and high fructose corn syrup.
Were talking about high fructose because they were talking about diabetes and things.
Yeah, so they officially made it a food.
So, yeah, I heard it just a couple weeks ago on national news.
Amazing. Okay, well, thanks for the heads up, Lee. I remember when I was a kid, you know, my parents didn't have a lot of money, particularly early on before my dad got a good job in a union shop. And instead of maple syrup on pancakes, we would put corn syrup on them, Karo syrup, because it was cheaper. But that was not high fructose corn syrup. That was just old-fashioned corn syrup. And frankly, it wasn't all that sweet. I remember hating this stuff. So Jerry in Spinola, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Jeremy.
How you doing, Tom? I had a question as to how we can do it to protest a sign that a church in our community has out in the grounds. It's a picture of an aborted fetus with the names of Democratic candidates under it and a picture of a happy, lively baby with Republican candidates. And on the bottom it says, you decide. And I know it's some type of violation of IRS tax laws. How would we pursue that? Who would we contact?
Contact your local IRS office and just tell them that you would like to challenge the tax-exempt status of that church and ask them how to go about it. I frankly don't know the process because I've never done it, but I have been on, you know, for over 20 years on the board of directors of a nonprofit organization, and I know that it can be done. So that would be the way to do it, Jeremy, is contact your local IRS office. Luke in Los Gatos. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Tom. I just want to let people know that Vincent Bugliosi, the famous prosecutor, he wrote a book about how he believes he can prosecute Bush, Cheney, and Rice for murder.
Yeah, he's been a guest on this show twice. And by the way, he doesn't pronounce the G in his name. It's Bugliosi.
Oh, sorry. So I just wanted to point out that, as I understand it, in order for him to get started, an attorney general for a state has to appoint him a special prosecutor. And there is a woman who's running for attorney general in Vermont who has stated that she will do it. She's a progressive, and she has it on her website. And if people want, they can go there and donate to help her campaign.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. We actually even discussed having her on as a guest. Here's the problem. I used to live in Vermont. I lived in Vermont for 10 years. And the Progressive Party in Vermont is a wonderful party. It's, you know, some great people. Anthony Polina was a friend. He ran for governor of Vermont. And in the last year that I lived in Vermont, or the last election cycle that I lived in Vermont, it was the year that Howard Dean retired as governor. And we had Jim, what's-his-name, who was the Republican running, and Anthony, and then there was a Democrat running. I've forgotten his name now, too. And between Anthony and the Democrat, they took over 60% of the vote. But because the Republican, Jim, what's-his-name, got slightly more than either one of the other two, with a minority of the vote, he became governor and still is. And she's the woman who is running for attorney general is running on the progressive ticket against a Democrat. And she's getting a lot, you know, there's a lot of people very excited about it. And odds are what's going to end up is that there's going to be a Republican attorney general in Vermont, which is crazy because of this. And I just, you know, I really wish that Vermont and Vermont actually, the legislature passed instant runoff voting in Vermont to solve this problem. And Jim, damn, I wish I could remember his last name. But anyhow, the governor of Vermont vetoed it in order to retain his own power. I mean, this is how crazy it gets. So in any case, yeah, it doesn't, by the way, it's not going to require only an attorney general. What Vince Bugliosi said on this show was that any prosecutor anywhere in the United States can have standing if there is any person in his jurisdiction. In other words, the prosecutor for the city of Los Angeles. If there's a family in Los Angeles whose son or daughter died in Iraq, and they're willing to assert that their child was the victim of murder because George Bush lied us into the war, then the prosecutor for the city of Los Angeles can go after Bush. So he's, what Bugliosi is trying to do is get literally hundreds of prosecutors all across the United States to file charges against Bush so that he can't go anywhere in the United States without getting nailed. Dave in Los Angeles, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Dave, we got a minute before the break. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Real quick, I was kind of worried about, you know, chicanery going on with the election, but I was really enheartened this morning. Read a piece there saying that if Obama fights this time, unlike Gore, and it goes to Supreme Court.
Gore actually fought it. He fought it all the way to the Supreme Court. It was Kerry who didn't fight.
But if he fights beyond that, it goes to the next level, which is to the House. If you remember the scene in Fahrenheit 9-1-1, if we get a Senate member this time along with a House member, then it becomes contested. They can take it. They can actually disqualify a state if they believe, if Congress believes that the election was not run correctly.
Right.
And if the candidate doesn't have 270 after that state is disqualified, then it goes to the Senate or the House to vote on, with each state getting one vote.
Right. And there's even a scenario out there where it could be 269 to 269. I mean, it's, you know, we'll see. But you're right. You're right, and that was the one disappointment with Al Gore, was that he asked the members of the House not to challenge it, but he was genuinely concerned about the fate and future of democracy in this country. I mean, I've talked with him about it. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Hey, thanks so much to Louise Hartman, to my producer, Sean Taylor, to Chris Rosen, Lauren Kirshner, and Marcus Hillman at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors. Hey, please call them up and let them know you're listening. And thanks to you for listening to our program. It is truly appreciated. And thanks to Ellen Ratner and the folks at the Talk Radio News Service, accredited White House, Pentagon, UN, congressional, serious reporters for every single day giving us a great update on what's going on in the world. Ellen Ratner with us, talkradionews.com is their website. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in the world?
Okay, well, Barney Frank said today that he wanted a tight control of the banks' use of what happens with those bailout funds. Remember I said yesterday that former economic advisor Stiglitz, Professor Stiglitz, was very said that Congress was very concerned about that. He'd obviously been talking to them because he said, Barney Frank said today, that banks that use infusions of federal funds for anything other than lending will be violating the terms of the rescue. Not terribly surprising, but apparently they are going to go after them.
Oh, interesting. How? I mean, what do they have legislative authority?
When we have
doesn't it require the Justice Department?
Well, I think what will happen is that when Congress, A, either comes back after the election for a lame duck, or we have a new president on Tuesday night, which I'm hoping, that they will begin to really say this is not tolerable, and they will begin to crack down even before January 20th.
But Congress doesn't have any police powers.
Right. Well, no, but they do have powers in which to call hearings, call people for Congress, testify, and refer it to the Justice Department.
Right. Okay. And Mukasey will ignore it, but he's going to be gone in January, and then maybe we can get something done.
Right. Exactly. Now, speaking of Senator Obama, I am hearing, and I heard this from very high up in my connections in the great state of Ohio, which, as you know, I always say you can take the girl out of Ohio, but you can't take Ohio out of the girl, that there have been, for early voting, lines up to an hour and a half of in Ohio, and this official said to me, those people are not voting for McCain, Ellen.
Yeah. Well, that's great to hear. In fact, you know, Bob Ney works for you. He's a former congressman from Ohio. What does Bob have to say about what's going on in Ohio?
Well, he thinks that Ohio is probably going to go Democrat. I should let you talk to him on Monday, and actually on Tuesday. I don't know if you're doing any special programming or anything, but we're both going to be in Ohio in Columbus on Tuesday.
Great. No, we'll be here doing our show live. Not any kind of special. I mean, you know, special to the effect to the extent that it's election day, but Wednesday.
Well, one of us will call in from Ohio because he's planning on going around to several of the questionable polling places, et cetera.
Oh, that would be great. I'd love to hear his thoughts.
And we have people in Virginia, and we're doing the same.
Great, great.
Also, the Washington Post actually said that there had been a late push to enact regulations favorable to the business community in terms of some of this deregulation stuff. The White House is completely denying that. Tony Fredo this morning said that the Post mischaracterized it. He said that new regulations are being processed according to usual standards, that they are preserving the integrity of the regulatory review process and keeping transparency, the public comment period, and agency review. And he said that he doesn't think that some of the regulations coming through are welcome from the business community. The Washington Post obviously stands by its story.
Right, yeah. If you believe anything Tony Fratto has to say, I've got a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn.
Remember yesterday I talked a little bit about the United Nations. Well, more with the United Nations. Jeffrey Sachs was there today, and he advises Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General. He is very worried about Millennial Development Aid. They are trying to get developed countries to spend 0.7% of their gross national product on aid, but of course most of the countries haven't come close to that.
Right, the United States being the millennial list, not coming close to it. Ellen, you and I were in Darfur in March, or we were on the border of Darfur in a hellhole in Gok Machar in southern Sudan for a week. And you know, many of our listeners may not know this story. We've picked up a bunch of radio stations since then. We did our show live from Darfur, and we saw people dying. We saw, you know, villages being burned. We saw hell on earth. What's the latest that you're hearing? You were just at the UN yesterday. What's the latest with the situation in Darfur? What's the latest with the situation with China in southern Sudan? The hour that we spent with Salva Kiir, the president of South Sudan, what's going on with him? You know, I don't have a full.
I will in a quick sort of nanosecond here. I do know that they are still having trouble with UN workers getting killed. In fact, I think somebody was just killed the other day.
Well, there were three murdered the week after we left, just 20
right.
miles from where we were.
Well, but that's still going.
That's still going on.
Obviously,
yeah.
They are the Chinese are pretty heavily involved there. And just a little other story going on about the Iran situation. Rumor has it that they are trying to, as I think I may have said, get out of the Gulf and do their own deal with Iran so that
the Chinese.
So that it does not have to go through the Arabian Gulf at all. So the Chinese are getting their mitts in there as much as possible. Now, there's also been some question about whether any of the Chinese have continued to cause real physical harm to any of the people from southern Sudan, and that is being taken up actually at the UN as well.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear it. Ellen Ratner, talkradionews.com, the website, and check it out. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Coming up Monday, it'll be the day before Election Day, and Ron Reagan's going to drop by to talk about the latest news on pivotal races and election issues from around the country. Plus, we'll be taking your calls and bringing you up to date on the latest of the news, Election 2008. Talking about candidates and two candidates who need a last-minute push from you. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.